I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and this is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change through the eyes of extraordinary men and women. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. You've all seen that trick where a clown pulls bright cloth out of his mouth. I sometimes think our role in telling stories is kind of the same, a stream of colorful storylines flowing evenly out of one person's mouth and into your ears. It's clean and it's clear, but sometimes there is another side to the story, other softer colors that deserve our attention. For the next 6 weeks, we've asked producers, composers, and sound designers to take their favorite Arrivals episodes and to recreate them in their style and their voice, a kind of podcast remix. Our first guest is Brian Garcia. He produces an incredible fictional storytelling podcast called Aural Regions. It's part modern radio drama and part internal monologue. Brian took our first episode, The Blazing Echidna, in a new and exciting direction. And if you haven't heard it yet, I encourage you to go back and listen to the first one. So here it is, another side of The Blazing Echidna.
I get to Lansing, and she shows up at the train, and I saw her face. And then she rolled down the window, it was raining, and I looked at her face and I said,
Either
you're leaving me,
you've had an affair,
or someone's died.
She said, just bike back to the apartment.
I biked back to the apartment, and she had an affair with another pre-med guy and was with him. Well, I just shipped all my things there, not a few boxes of things. So that was it. So I was on the next train out. There wasn't a train for 3 days, so I sat in her apartment crying for 3 days. I was very loyal, so I was very heartbroken.
I guess I was so broken, I had no ego left to lash out.
Seeing her senior day, knowing she had already moved on in her heart, physically, and that was a heartbreak. I had to be around her for three days.
It just really.
I wasn't angry. I was just in this really soft place.
And
wrote a letter to the man she's with now, and just hoped that they found happiness. And from some of the story, he resisted a little bit. Said, hey, let's wait till he comes back, but they had this chemistry, and so I just thanked him for thinking of me.
And
she was a master's in New Orleans in public health, and I was down there for a few months, and I would bike to meet up with them, and there's places in the town where someone just got knocked off a bike with a baseball bat, and I'd go through any neighborhood, and so she would get really stressed. Saturday night in New Orleans, drunk drivers everywhere. There's no bike lanes in New Orleans like a Portland, and I'm biking around trying to be car free. There was stresses.
Every time we ever went out to eat, my commitment was never to walk by someone in need.
And someone would come up and ask for food, and I'd say, hey, come on out to eat with us. And
it was kind of
the world and our relationship didn't have a boundary, which I totally understand. When she left me, my mom and all my friends were like, you should just be a monk.
Gosh, I want a family.
Like, really, if I make these choices, I have to be alone? And so many people searching for a soulmate use the other strategy. You know, okay, I've lost this woman I love, Kat. I loved her dearly, and I still love her, and she stretched so far to meet me.
It's just too much.
Yeah, so all of a sudden,
I'm like, where do I go?
It's the first time in my life, where do I go? I'm heartbroken. And so I called my friend Brian, who had gone around the world. I'd just given away $100,000 inheritance and given away everything just because I wanted to try it. I was in Indonesia. I can't remember when I got the call that had inherited this money, and in the moment I heard it, it's like, wow, because I was just going around the world doing service work, writing to the kids I was on this high, and like, I don't need it, because I was driving without it. My initial gut was give it away, but I waited. a little bit. I wasn't there yet, so I was put in a bank account. And then what I noticed when I got home, when I sat
with it,
all those stories of money equaling happiness money equaling you live your wildest dreams. And it was disturbing. And I noticed that it was like this poison. People I really respected equated your dreams with money.
Oh, you've got the big break. Now you've got $150,000.
So what
big urge for me was,
I don't want to do that. I want to show you can live your dreams with nothing. All the mystics say, you want to be happy, like
give everything away and trust.
I had paid off my college loans, and then the family had inherited this money, and I decided to just liquidate everything. My family flipped out. I realized I had everything I needed. I'm okay.
Like, I really want to give it.
But give it in a meaningful way. The three most important things to me were
ending war and poverty,
species extinction, and friends and family. So we came up with this idea of a chunk, a third to each. And from other money sources and everything, it ended up being a pools of almost $50,000 in each bracket. Take a pond. If you store all the water in the pond and it can't flow downstream, everything downstream dies. So I have all these resources that could actually be making more of the world I want
in this moment
instead of waiting for some time in the future. The tricky one was friends and family, so I created the Dream Fund. And when I gave it to friends or family, I said, you have to use this to follow one of your most important dreams. That's the only stipulation. Can't put it in. One friend put the check up on his bureau and just thought about it every day. And the check bounced. You know, it was too late. But he said, I don't want the money.
It made me really think about what is most important.
Every day he looked at it and he didn't have a dream at that moment. So that was like giving it away, and it became a positive addiction. So I was free from that. I gave it all away. It was fine. When I met Sarah, I was madly in love with Sarah. I was into solar at that time.
Solar panels.
Electricity free. I'd never even thought about it.
Candlelight.
I was like, yeah, who is this woman? I told her I was car free. She's like, great, let's bike to the local play. One of our early dates, I wanted to take her to the coast because I love the ocean. We get off the Greyhound with our bikes, and we're going to bike down to this camping area. And of course, an intoxicated man in Coos Bay walks up and is like, do you have any money? My commitment is,
hey, what's your name? Yeah, I don't want to just give you money. Let's go eat me together.
But in the moment he asked me, all the past pain of lost partners because of my radicalization.
I was terrified.
And so I said, screw it, she'll leave me, but this will be our date with the drunken homeless man. And we went to a little cafe, the closest place, and we ate together. And Sarah gave him a big hug, and I gave him a big hug, and then we got on our bikes after being together for an hour with him. It's not the idea that I'm going to change his life, but just that you're a human being. I'm going to sit with you and find out your story.
That would be the beginning of a shift.
And we're walking back to the bikes. Sarah looks at me and she said, This is the best date I've ever been on.
I cry when I talk about it. It's like,
in that moment, I'm like, I found my soulmate. I realized, like, wow, actually, when you follow your heart
imperfectly,
I've done it very imperfectly,
but with full effort,
eventually, you're going to meet and come together with who you need to meet.
And we've been a catalyst for each other.
So now we're like a small partnership, really supportive. And we have kids now. Gift economy, give all our money away. We don't charge for anything, where we teach classes. And
I have partners like yes.
Not like, whoa. But when I'm having a hard day, she can support me.
Remember,
let's take the extra effort to walk and find a local garden. Or I'll grab her and like, remember, this person we're walking by, even though we're going to the Swan Boats, is our family. Let's feed and sit with this person. Which this path, I tell people, like, they're like, oh, it seems so amazing. You seem so at ease, and you trust, and your bike gets stolen. You're like, oh, and then another bike shows up, and
If someone asks for your bike, you'll give it to them. Like, that's freedom. But there's also...
There is heartbreak.
There is heartbreak. Gosh, maybe if I'm lucky, I'll save 3 birds and 1 human being. You know, with full effort, it's humbling to realize there's 7 billion people. There's millions of species of just beetles.
You're just a tiny piece of this ripple. And I think that's the heartbreak we have to go through.
Arrivals is written, produced, and recorded on a quiet street in a loud town in the lovely East Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, by me, Jonathan Hirsch, along with Gabrielle Lewis and Ben Cruz. Special thanks to Brian Garcia for producing today's episode and to Ethan for sharing his story. And if you've ever wondered how we discovered a superhero philanthropist, stay tuned. En route, our microcast about Arrivals, life in transit, and so much more is returning next week with that very story. You can find those episodes, our journal, and a host of other cool Arrivals-related material on our website, arrvls.com. And if you like what you've heard today, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. You'll find a link at the top of our website, and it's one of the few ways that we have as podcasters to spread the word. And it really does help. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.